So thank you very much. So today I'm going to talk about quantum error correction on black holes. So let me first introduce my collaborators: Daniel Harrell, Ferdinand Pastowsky, John Preskill, Xiaolian Ti, Daniel Roberts. So I guess as you can see, this was a very interdisciplinary collaboration. So I guess so these two are high energy physicists and these two are quantum info theorists, and he is a condensed matter theorist. So it was a lot of fun. And I guess because of this interdisciplinary nature, I would like to make the talk as pedagogical as possible, not go into technical details. And also, questions are very welcome. And but still, before starting my talk, I would like to give like an overview of the sort of this type of project, that is quantum gravity and quantum information. So the basic motivation is very simple. That is quantum mechanics and general relativity, or theory of classical gravity, are in serious conflict, and their mutual inconsistency can be seen in a most vivid way in the form of the information loss puzzle, which just says that quantum mechanics says that information is never lost, but general relativity says that information may be lost inside a black hole. And of course, we want to resolve these paradoxes, unify these two theories, and construct some theory of quantum gravity. But most importantly, by using these intuitions, we want to predict properties of black holes and the universe and so on. Okay, then why is quantum information theory useful for this purpose? Well, I guess it's by definition because, well, quantum information theory is a theory for solving information problems in quantum systems. So I guess I would even like to say that if quantum information theory is not useful for resolving information loss puzzle, then we quantum information theorists should feel ashamed of it. And indeed, there are many interesting examples, breakthrough ideas in quantum gravity or more broadly high energy physics, which came from quantum information theory. So I have listed several examples, but I'm pretty sure there are many other examples too. But here, there is one thing I want to emphasize is that, of course, in these examples, quantum information theory were very useful and played a very important role. But at the same time, they sort of gave birth to some new, totally new kind of research avenue in a totally unexpected manner. Personally, I feel that, well, whatever the questions of, or problems of quantum gravity, eventually these questions should be solved by theory of quantum gravity, not by quantum information theory itself. But the point is, quantum information theory can provide a new insight into the problem and sharpen our understanding. And these are the kind of contributions we quantum information theorists can make. And I guess the same story holds for condensed matter physics and even AMO physics and so on, or any researches involving quantum many-body systems. Okay, so that's the kind of overview, but I think it's just easy to say that quantum information theory will be useful, and the question is, what is my own contribution? So the main message of today's talk is this one, that is, black hole is actually a quantum error correcting code. This may sound like a bit of slogan, but by the end of the talk, I think you will understand this message. Okay, so let's get started. So my talk has two parts. In the first part of the talk, I would like to present a simple toy model of the ADS-CFT correspondence. It's actually, I'm going to demonstrate that ADS-CFT correspondence is a realization of quantum error correcting code. Then in the second part of the talk, by using these ideas, I would like to attack the information loss puzzle and try to give new insight into the problem by using the idea of error correction, quantum error correcting code. Okay, so the starting point is this ADS-CFT correspondence. This is a conjectured equivalence between string theory living on the bulk of this negatively curved hyperbolic space and certain types of conformal field theory living on the boundary. So here in this example, it's a d-dimensional conformal field theory without any gravity. So it's a purely quantum mechanical system. And then this is the gravitational theory living on this bulk. And then even though they look very different from each other, they are secretly equivalent to each other. That's essentially the statement of ADS-CFT correspondence. But to have a better intuition about this problem, it's actually convenient to have this cartoon picture. That is, you have one-dimensional qubits living on the boundary. They are strongly interacting with each other. And then on this side, you have qubits living on a two-dimensional ADS space, ADS3. These qubits. The point is, this is a quantum mechanical system. This is a gravitational system because the space-time is curved. And the statement is the following. This bulk degrees of freedom, bulk physics, is completely encoded into this boundary degrees of freedom, like a hologram. So this is the reason why we call this as an example of holographic principle. And then I'm going to argue that this encoding is like a quantum miracle encoding. OK, so in order to construct a toy model, I would like to have a few guiding principles. So first guiding principle is this Deutte-Carnegie formula. So the problem setting is the following. You have this boundary theory, interacting theory, and then you want to compute the entanglement entropy for this region A. Then what Ryu and Takanagi found is the following. In order to find this entanglement entropy, all you need to do is you just need to compute the, find the minimal length or minimal surface covering this region A. So in this example, it's much shorter to go inside the bulk instead of go near the boundary because of the negative curvature. I guess you can see this, right? Yeah. And even more, they found that this proportionality factor is this 1 over 4 times g Newton, where this is a gravitational constant. So this formula is remarkable because left-hand side, you have purely quantum mechanical quantity. On right-hand side, you have purely geometric quantity, the length of the curve. So this is like a concrete example of a broad slogan that gravity may be emerging from quantum entanglement. And this RT formula has a very interesting kind of geometric nature. That is, if you have two boundary regions, then all you need to do is you need to look for the global minima, not the local minima. So this is a local minima, dotted line, but this is shorter. Then they say that this is the entanglement entropy. So this is the RT formula. So it was found around 10 years ago. But around the same time, there was another interesting breakthrough in condensed matter / quantum information community by, well, someone in this room. So he proposed that this powerful numerical method to study strongly coupled, strongly correlated system, especially conformal field theory. The idea is we use this tensor network in a hierarchical way, and then each layer you sort of remove short-range entanglement. By doing this, you can distribute entanglement in a scale-invariant manner. So this is what we call the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And after this proposal was made, Brian Swingle made a very interesting conjecture. That is, maybe the physics of ADS-CFT correspondence can be explained by this tensor network, especially MERA. And I guess his only intuition is that these two figures look similar, because yeah, look similar, right? And then, but there is an important subtlety, because in MERA, this entanglement entropy for this region is upper bounded by this length. But in the case of ADS-CFT, it's saturated, like upper bound is saturated. So this is a big, very big difference. So of course, the question is, can we find such a tensor network toy model? And then, well, of course, we are going to provide the answer to this question. OK, now let us go further into details of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So we want to basically understand the correspondence between bulk operators and boundary operators, because so the problem setting, the situation I'm considering the following. Imagine that you have some bulk operator phi acting on this space point. Then the question is, because of the ADS-CFT correspondence, there must exist boundary operator which corresponds to this phi operator. Then the question is, how do we find such a thing? And this entanglement wedge reconstruction theorem provides a sort of answer or a partial answer to this question. So this is how it works. You first pick some boundary region A, and then you look for the minimal surface. And you notice that this is contained inside this tiny region, which is called entanglement wedge. In this case, this theorem says that phi has a corresponding boundary operator exclusively supported on this region A. This is the entanglement wedge reconstruction. And similarly, if you have multiple boundary regions, then this is the entanglement wedge. So then there is an operator living on A1 and A2 joint region. So this is the statement of the entanglement with the reconstruction. I want to give a few technical comments that is for experts. That is, well, there have been, like last year, there have been like proofs of this theorem. But these theorems are existence proof. It's not a constructive proof in a sense that it doesn't give explicit recipe to construct such boundary operator, especially when there are more than one boundary region. But this is a very important question because it is, so if you think about two-sided black hole, then this entanglement wedge may go beyond the black hole horizon. So then it is closely related to other interesting questions such as firewall paradox and so on. But in this talk, all we need is this correspondence. And so it's like a generalization of the RT formula at the level of operators. Okay, so far so good. But unfortunately, this entanglement wedge reconstruction has led to a certain paradox. This paradox has been clearly pointed out in a paper by Al-Mahawi, Don, and Harrow. So let me follow their argument. So they call it bulk locality paradox. So now let's prepare this hyperbolic disk and split the boundary region into three regions, A, B, C. Then I'm going to concentrate on this bulk operator at the center. And you notice that this bulk point is contained inside the wedge of the BC, wedge of AB, wedge of AC. But this is very problematic because the conclusion is that this bulk operator has a corresponding boundary operator which is supported on BC, AB, AC. But there is only such an operator that is an identity operator, well, times some complex phase. Even worse, I can repeat this argument for any bulk point. So the conclusion I can draw is all the bulk operators in the ADS-CFT correspondence must correspond to identity operator on the boundary. But if this is the case, ADS-CFT correspondence sounds very boring. So what was wrong? So that was the paradox pointed out. So the question is, how do we resolve this paradox? And then the one possible answer is to use the idea of quantum error correcting code. So that is ADS-CFT correspondence may be viewed as an error correcting code. So what was wrong in my previous argument is the following. I implicitly assume that there exists only a single boundary operator. But maybe it's wrong. It's just there are three operators, OBC, OAB, OCA. They are three different operators, but they act in the same manner inside the low energy subspace you are interested in. And it's actually the existence of different operators which act on the same way inside the low energy subspace is a signature or defining feature of the quantum error correcting code. And if you are from condensed matter or high energy physics, you can recall the like lattice gauge theory or G2 spin liquid where put on the torus where you have string-like operators and you are free to deform these string operators, but still they act in the same manner inside the low energy ground state space. So, and then such a theory is often called the toric code. It's a very good quantum error code. But in our specific this realization of the ADS-CFT correspondence, the right way to interpret this situation is to view it as a quantum secret sharing code. So imagine that you have three people, Alice, Bob, Charlie, and then they share certain quantum secret encoded into this bulk operator. Then it is outside of Alice's entanglement wedge, so Alice cannot access this information. But if Alice collaborates with Bob, then they can access this information. So it's like this quantum secret is shared among three people. And even more importantly, this situation has a resilience against errors. So for example, if Alice decided to leave this collaboration, then still Bob and Charlie can collaborate with each other and then access this quantum information. So in this error correcting code, it's actually information is protected against erasure of one party. Okay. Now I think that's good for introduction. So what happened is actually the following. So is Daniel Harrow. So he visited Caltech and he gave a seminar and then he talked many things. But at the end of the talk, basically he told to three of us to construct a toy model, and that's what we did. And so after Daniel's seminar, I and Ferdinand Pastowski ate dinner together, two of us, and then we talked about how to construct a toy model. And actually, we came up with the toy model within like 2 hours. So I'm going to closely follow our conversations over the dinner. So it should be very simple. So you shouldn't be scared. It's a very simple toy model. Anyway, but this is how our collaboration started. So since I want to have a very simple toy model, I want to assume the following. That is, I only have one bulk qubit and only 5 boundary qubits. So my universe is made of just 6 qubits. It's a 64-dimensional Hilbert space. So it's very simple. Then I would like to deduce the key property this toy model should have. So first of all, I have this entanglement wedge reconstruction. So if I have A, B, C, D, E, these are boundary qubits. This is contained inside the wedge of A, B, C. So this bulk operator should have a corresponding boundary operator on A, B, C, right? And B, C, D, C, D, E, and so on. Similarly, if I split the boundary like this, then this operator should have a corresponding representation on A, B, D. So this is a property I want my toy model to have. But if you look at these figures for a while, then you notice that this is equivalent to saying that the bulk operator must have a corresponding boundary operator in any region with 3 qubits. That you pick 3 out of 5. Okay, so this is the guiding principle. This is a property I want my toy model to have. Then we thought about it a little bit, and then we just realized that, oh, we quantum information theorists already know the answer. That is the 5-qubit quantum error correcting code. The idea is you prepare arbitrary 1-qubit quantum state written in this form, and then encode it into a 5-qubit output state. So this C0 and C1 are some 5-qubit entangled state, which actually I can show it to you. It looks like this. Maybe it's not illuminating to you, but the point is it's a highly entangled state. That's the most important part. But forgetting about details of how you construct this code, let me just tell you that this 5-qubit code indeed satisfies the property I mentioned before. So for example, given a bulk Pauli X operator, then you can actually construct this list of the 3-body boundary operator on any region with 3 qubits. So by correspondence, I mean that acting X operator on this input qubit state is same as acting, let's say, these 3-body Pauli operator on this output state. So this is exactly the property we are looking for. So we seem to find that this 5-qubit code is actually a very, very, very small toy model of the quantum gravity.
I missed something.
Right.
Why is it important that any 3, that you can represent a logical qubit by any 3 boundary operators? Where did that criterion come from? A few slides back, you said that.
This one?
Yeah, that statement in the bracket. How did you come with that?
So this means that I have a representation of A, B, C, B, C, D, C, D, E, D, E, A, and so on, right? And then this means that I have a representation of A, B, D, and there are cyclic things. But that's enough to explore all the regions with 3 qubits out of 5 qubits.
Okay. But I'm seeing that this looks like there's no real entanglement wedge here. I guess in a discrete model.
Right. It's a discrete model, yeah? Yeah.
So you can't really find an entanglement wedge.
I kind of agree, but it's just like, well, it's too small to talk about geometry, right? So I'm just deducing the key property which is responsible for this entanglement wedge and so on in ADS-CFD correspondence at the level of very small system size. And then you can imagine that I'm putting these 5-qubit on a kind of hyperbolic space. And then if you really want to have a geometry, then you can have a graph like this. You can draw lines. And then you can say that it's a discrete graph, and you can introduce metric and then talk about these things.
I see, but I guess what I'm asking is, what's wrong if I said the same statement you made, but instead of 3 qubits, I put 4 qubits? I say that a bulk operator must have corresponding boundary operators on a region with 4 instead of 3. What's wrong with that?
Because it's spherically symmetric, so I guess, I mean, so it's the point is this point is either included or excluded, and then I have three regions they included and two regions excluded, so it's like.
I see.
Yeah. So that's the, you have sharp transition.
Okay,
so. Anyway, so where am I? So yeah, I wanted to say that this is indeed a quantum error correcting code. Maybe it's already obvious, but you can lose these two qubits and still you can recover the original information. And all these arguments work for Pauli X and Pauli Y and Pauli Z operator. Okay, so it's good, but I agree that this system is very small. So let me make it bigger. And in order to do that, I will use the technique of tensor network. And again, I'm not going to go into details of tensor network theory, but the point is you prepare this 5-qubit code, a lot of them, and you prepare this hyperbolic disk and then discretize it, then place these objects at each patch. What we are going to do is we place 5-qubit code at each node. So I'm showing only two, but I will do it everywhere. Now, the point is, at every edge where two qubits meet, we are going to project the state into this EPR pair, 00 plus 11. This is equivalent to saying that we do the tensor contraction. And we do this contraction or projection at every edges. So in the end, you are left with this input bulk qubit, shown in red, and the output boundary qubit, because all the qubits on the bulk are projected out, except on the boundary, you have some blue qubits. So this is how it looks like. So red qubits are living on the bulk, and then blue qubits are living on the boundary. And you can view it as a quantum error correcting code. That is, you, let's say, fix some input quantum state, and this spits out some output wave function living on the boundary. So it's like this ADS geometry works as an encoder of this quantum information. So this is like a realization of the holography. So basically, this is the construction of the holographic quantum error correcting code. Now I want to talk about the properties of these models. First important property is this entanglement wedge reconstruction. And you can actually easily verify that the wedge reconstruction works. So this is a wedge reconstruction for one region. This is a wedge reconstruction for two regions. But again, like you can play with these operator algebra and then you can verify these things. And of course, this 5-qubit code property is very important in proving these statements. And another property is we can tweak the model a little bit and then talk about the state. And then, again, I'm not going to go into details, but the point is if we construct state version of our tensor network, then you have some boundary wave function, and then you can show that the Ryota-Carnegie formula holds. And well, that's good, but the way this is proven is quite beautiful and physically illuminating. That is, basically, you need to think about coarse-graining RG transformation in radial direction. But this coarse-graining transformation has a direct interpretation of the distillation protocol of EPR pairs. And after running this RG algorithm, you end up having EPR pairs along the geodesy. It's kind of beautiful. Okay, so I think our model passed the very basic test of the ADS CFD correspondence. But what's actually the physical picture of these models? Well, physical picture is basically the following. We are considering the qubits, and on the bulk, these represent matter field, which are coupled to the geometry by this 5-qubit code tensors. So for example, you can place all 0 qubits on the bulk, and then it defines as some vacuum of a CFD. And then if you flip spin here, then it affects all these qubits. So it's like you are creating a long wavelength, low energy excitation. So this is a physical picture. Now, you might have noticed one perplexing feature of our model, that is the bulk Hilbert space seems to be much, much smaller than the boundary Hilbert space, right? There are much more bulk boundary qubit than bulk qubit. And is this a problem? And I would say this is actually the feature of the model, because the point is this model captures perturbations around the fixed geometry. And so like adding this tiny excitation here is like a very adding a tiny perturbation to the background metric so that we can neglect the back reaction to the metric. This is the regime we are interested in and we are talking about. If you want to go actually outside of this low energy subspace, what you can do is actually you act with some heavy operators, then you can go outside the code world, which will change the geometry inside. And one example of such operation on the bulk is putting like a micro black hole. And so going outside of the black code world space corresponds to reaching to this black hole microstate.
Bennett?
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah. So how did you determine that putting a one there affected the excited state on that region as a boundary? I'm confused about this statement. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to put it together with the statement that an operator on that location in the bulk mm-hmm. could be reconstructed from different places.
Right. So this excited state, there are two different ways to create it. One is acting these operators. The other is acting this and this operator. But they just create the same excited state.
Right. And you characterize that excited state mm-hmm. at the boundary?
At the boundary, yes.
By illuminating in red one possible region where the operator would be acting on the boundary? So what's the meaning of having red?
Oh, having red is...
just the domain, the support
support of power x operator.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Corresponding.
So that's what it means.
That's all what I mean.
One possible choice.
One possible choice. Okay. Okay, so this is the interpretation, and then, so I have been talking about this 5-qubit code, but honestly, I don't believe that my space-time is made of 5-qubit code. So the key question I think we should address is, what was the universal properties which made these interesting properties possible? And for this purpose, actually, I need to go one technical detail, which is called state tensor duality. This is a very abstract idea, but it's very important when you talk about gravity and entanglement. So let me just mention it. So tensor is just an object with these indices, and these tensor indices and then 0 or 1 in the case of qubits, and then they take C numbers, complex numbers. So it's a very simple object. But interestingly, this given a tensor, you can always view it as a quantum state. And the trick is very easy. You just do this. It's a tensor, and then you put this basis state. And then you have pure state. This is the construction. It's very easy, right? So this is a state tensor duality. And then why do we want to do that? I just rewrote tensor to a state. And the point is, by using this state representation, you can talk about entanglement of these tensors. For example, this 5-qubit code is a tensor with one input reg and five output reg. But I'm free to view it as a 6-qubit state. Now, if I view this object as a 6-qubit state, then I can talk about coding property of the 5-qubit code very easily just by using entanglement entropy. For example, I have been arguing that this 5-qubit code hides the quantum information very well. It delocalizes the quantum information. This means that input information about A cannot be reconstructed from, let's say, local region B or local region C. But this is just same as saying that A and B are not entangled with each other. There is no correlation between A and B. If we want to establish a correlation with A, you need to pick larger region, for example, 3 qubits, B, C, D, then you can establish. But for small region, it's not possible. So this is the power of this state tensor duality. You can talk about properties of codes and tensors just by using entanglement entropies. And another example is that if you pick 3 legs, so in this case, I pick A, B, C, and D, E, F, then now you can view it as a linear operator with 3 in and 3 out. And this tensor, this linear operator, is actually a unitary operator if A, B, C is maximally entangled with D, E, F. If it's not maximally entangled, there is an information loss, so it's just a quantum operation. And this picture is very useful because we can find a very peculiar and very defining feature of this 5-qubit quantum error correcting code, which is the perfectness of the code. So again, let us view this 5-qubit quantum error correcting code as a 6-qubit state. So some of the lake is input and the other 5 are output, but I'm viewing it as a 6-qubit state. Then this 6-qubit state is perfect in the following sense. You can pick any 3 qubits out of 6-qubit, and then you find that its entropy is always maximal. So this 3-qubit is maximally entangled with the other 3 qubits. This 3-qubit is maximally entangled with other 3 qubits. This 3-qubit maximally entangled with other 3 qubits. So this state seems to have an enormous entanglement, like everywhere. Everything is like entangled with each other in a very complicated manner. This is very important because if I have such a tensor, then I can construct 3-in-3-out tensor and then define like various kinds of unitary operators. So in this example, I can define unitary operator where information go into this direction and then go coming out into these 3 directions. But you can define unitary with these 3 input like this and then 3 output. So information is not like completely geometrically localized, but can go into different direction. And you see that this is always 3-in, 3-out. So it's like a kind of flow of entanglement going on here. And the statement is that if as long as you have perfect tensors or perfect state, if you consider such a tensor network, then you can construct a quantum error correcting code with similar property I have been talking about. So this is the key properties which made our construction successful. Okay, so then I think final question is, of course, how do we create such perfect tensors? It sounds very difficult to create, but it turns out it's actually the opposite. It's extremely easy to create. The idea is, it's actually if you have random state, random quantum state, then it is nearly maximally entangled along any bipartition. So you think about all list of quantum state and then you pick one of them randomly. That is what I mean by random quantum state. And this statement follows from, this statement has been proven in a very different forms, but it has been used by Page to argue that in his famous black hole evaporation argument, and it's often called canonical typicality. But the main message is that given such a geometry, all you need to do is you just place some random tensor. You just give me some like really random object, and then I just place it here, and then it works. So it's a very simple construction. And even more, I said it's nearly, so there is a tiny, tiny error to the perfectness of the tensor. But this error has a very interesting interpretation as like 1 over s or 1 over n corrections. And this 1 over n correction has been explicitly studied analytically in a recent paper by Matt Hastings and Patrick Hayden and his collaborators. And they actually provided a very beautiful 1 over n type interpretation to this structure of entanglement. Anyway, so it seems that the space-time is made of something very random. And it's quite illuminating that, many times we encounter with this randomness in the argument of black holes, like how random unitary operators, SYK model, and random matrices, and so on. It seems like all these different ideas are coming together. It's very exciting. Anyway, okay, so now, I think I need to finish the first part of the talk, so I would like to give a future aspects, like future view. And actually, like after we wrote this paper 2 years ago, actually many people have worked on this, and then many generalizations are discussed. So I must confess that I was not able to catch up with all these developments, but there are still, I'm pretty sure, many open questions which need to be addressed. For example, we should, of course, talk about the toy model of the black holes. Of course, it's easy to construct toy model of a black hole. You can do this, you can do this. You just give me some geometry and I can tie it with some random tensor. It's very easy. But the question we would like to address is probably like, we consider different kinds of the geometry behind the horizon, and then we can study entanglement properties, and then we might be able to study interior of the black hole and smoothness of the horizon and so on. This question is, of course, very related to the recent conjecture by Susskind and his friends on this complexity equals to volume equals to action. Well, actually, in the tensor network picture, it's just number of tensors is complexity. But the point is, if we have such a tensor network toy model, then the geometry behind the horizon definitely manifests as an entanglement property on the boundary. So by using that, we can gain more insight into the relation between entanglement and geometry. And of course, we should think about more generalization. Like we could add some symmetries, conical defect and so on. And also, instead of C numbers, maybe it would be interesting to talk about matrix degree of freedom. And we want to talk about sub-ADS locality. And finally, there is another interesting thoughts on the tensor network coming. And this is called kinematic space. And it will be very interesting to explore such relation. I'm actually particularly interested in this tensor network in Dojitra space because our universe is Dojitra, not anti-Dojitra. And interestingly, our tensor network, but in defined in a Dojitra space, was actually kind of mentioned by Eric Fehrinde in his recent paper on dark matter problem. So maybe there is an interesting connection to these questions. But I must say that there are still many, many missing properties. That is, I think the key difficulty in our construction is because we didn't start from any Hamiltonian. So it's very difficult to talk about dynamics. So it seems to me that we definitely need some fixed background geometry to talk about the physics. And in order to overcome these difficulties, we need more inputs to make it more the toy more realistic. But that's a kind of future problem. So anyway, so this is the end of the first part of the talk. So maybe if you have questions, you can stop me. But yeah.
So at some point you said that the conclusion seemed to be that random tensor networks mm-hmm. already were the key to providing mm-hmm. producing a toy model that had interesting properties.
Right, right.
But when you say random, you mean large number of tensors with large number of coefficients, right?
Large number of coefficients.
They don't have to be random. If they are random, that's true. But the properties that you want to follow from mm-hmm. from lack of structure within the tensor.
Within the tensor, yes, yes. But this random tensor model is very beautiful because it has some approximation error, which has nice gravitational interpretations. Well, it's actually doesn't exactly match to the real ADS CFT scenario because in ADS CFT, so what they computed is Reni 2, Reni 3 entropies, but for Reni 2 RT formula, we need to consider back reaction. And for these models, we are not good at dealing with this back reaction. So that part we don't.
So is there a clear line between what this toy model reproduces and what they don't reproduce?
What is they?
The models. So uh-huh. say your model.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I was working in strong gravity,
uh-huh.
I came here expecting a black hole. It's like, where is the black hole, right? So
uh-huh.
there
uh-huh.
are some aspects that your model is reproducing about the
mm-hmm.
black hole,
mm-hmm.
for instance, error correction.
Mm-hmm.
Properties
mm-hmm.
that you can read the bulk observable from
uh-huh.
different parts
uh-huh.
of the boundary,
mm-hmm.
but there are other things that this model does not reproduce.
Right. So I think our model is not good at this point, it's not good at dealing with dynamics, for example. It's very difficult. So, well, but I would like to say that this is the same difficulty strong gravity people are facing because dynamics is very difficult to deal with. So we typically start with fixed boundary, fixed geometry, and then talk about small perturbations. That's a very typical approach. Of course, there are exceptions, but I really don't know how to, let's say, deal with creation of black hole in this model, for example. It seems very difficult to me.
Okay, but you are already yeah. saying this is a black hole.
So I'm picking up this black hole geometry and then tiling tensor. That is what I'm doing. And then I can predict properties. For example, whether I have an interior or not, this information definitely manifests in the boundary entanglement properties. Yes.
When you said with this complexity action conjecture, when you said the number of tenses is equal to the complexity, is it because your tenses are isometry, so you can just think of it as a circuit, or?
Right, right, and especially in the regime they are interested in, the part where the part of the geometry which is responsible for the growth of the complexity is actually almost flat. So then if it's flat, then it's just like two in, two out, or unitary. It's actually the crude model is just a random unitary circuit. Well, yes.
So, I mean, for Hamiltonian,
mm-hmm.
is there an objection to just taking, like if you have the original toy model,
mm-hmm.
there's kind of the sum over the generators or something of the Hamiltonian.
Oh, generators of
stabilizers.
Because stabilizers are pretty non-local.
Right.
And that's the problem. So as long as we want to, OK, my speculation is as long as I want to do these codes by using stabilizer type, frustration-free type characterizations, then we would encounter with like non-local operators. And I think this code word subspace and so on, it looks like degenerate space, but in reality, they are not degenerate. It's like approximate degeneracy. So maybe if we relax these parts a little bit, I might be able to decompose terms into a local terms. But at this point, like I could write down Hamiltonian by using stabilizer generators, but it's non-local. Of course, I should add very small coefficient in front of it, because if it's big operator, it's a long wavelength. So I should. But still, it's non-local. Yeah, maybe.
Is it fair to say that you say this is a toy model for the CFT, but
mm-hmm.
it's only a model capturing the quantum information aspects of the CFT?
Well, entanglement, yeah, sure.
Right, for example, I mean, ADCFT is also a strong weak duality.
Ah, I see.
And what's useful about it?
It's a weak gravity limit. So what we are doing
in
is...
In your model, there's no... No
tunable parameter. Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
So maybe that's why this random tensor model is interesting, because I have tensors with some bond dimensions on them. If I take bond dimensions to infinity there, I have a pure gravity limit. Like gravity is, how can I say? So 1 over n correction is suppressed. So there is some parameter, like 1 over n.
I see.
But of course, in order to make this more realistic, we need to put more physical inside. Yeah.
So all the tensors are unitary, like for any three in, three out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But how can the random tensor be unitary?
Oh, so it's approximately unitary. So three in, three out, almost unitary. But in their construction, it's actually there is a tiny loss of information.
But how do you?
I'm saying that it's not a good thing. I do agree, but that's the feature of their model. Maybe fixing these subtleties may resolve these subtle difference from between real ADS CFT correspondence and that. But at this point, I don't know the answer.
But how do you construct the tensor such that it's unitary for any three in, three out?
Oh, so you just pick a random tensor, and then from some discrete set, which is called, let's say, stabilizer state, then because of the discreteness, with high probability, with some probability, you will definitely hit like perfect tensor, not nearly perfect tensor. It's possible to do that. And also, there is a constructive way of doing this. I think I should probably, because I have part two. Anyway, so part two is, I think we have learned about quantum error correcting code, and the main message is that gravity is very good at hiding quantum information. So now I want to come back to the original question about information loss paradox. And so I want to argue that the black hole is a quantum error correcting code. Let me briefly recap this information loss puzzle. The setting is the following. you throw certain unknown quantum state into a black hole. Then later, this comes back as a Hawking radiation. And then Hawking computed that this looks like e to the minus beta h. But this is very problematic because no matter what kind of state you prepare, it ends up in the same state. So this is an information loss. But from modern perspective, we would like to think in the following way, that is, instead of being information being lost, it is hidden into some non-local degrees of freedom. That is, if you locally look at the system, they look like e to the minus beta h. But if you are able to globally measure everything, then you'll be able to reconstruct this quantum state. And then so there is no information loss. And such a delocalization of quantum information is often called scrambling in the literature. So this is an information loss puzzle problem. But since we have learned quantum error correcting code, this situation is very similar to quantum error correcting code because you have input qubit state and black hole state, then they interact with each other, and then later they come out. There's some Hawking radiation comes out. But the point is, by just measuring Hawking radiation, you are not able to access this information. It's like you cannot reconstruct this operator by these degrees of freedom. So in this sense, this black hole situation is very similar to the quantum error correction. Actually, in this language, this Hawking radiation is like an error, loss of qubits. And then input quantum qubits is protected from the loss of qubits. It's a Hawking radiation. So it's like quantum error correcting code. But of course, I'm not the first one to point out that the black hole may be a quantum error correcting code. Many people have speculated such things. So I think the real question is, how do we prove or disprove such a conjecture, right? How do we prove that, let's say, see that the black hole is a quantum error correcting code? Now, fortunately, there was a recent breakthrough in string theory community by Schenk and Stanford and Kitaev. So they proposed something called out-of-time ordered correlation functions. So in physics, we often talk about correlation functions. But this out-of-time ordered correlation function is very weird in a sense that you write a correlator in the following way. That is, OA act on 0, OB act on time t, OC act on time 0, OD act on time t. So you need to go to the future, past. This is a very non-trivial quantity. So at time 0, all these operators commute with each other. So it's not that interesting. But after the time evolution, this OB and OD operators are sort of dressed, becomes big operator. Then they no longer commute with each other. Therefore, you start to see something non-trivial. And this is the out-of-time ordered correlation functions. And what these people found is that in order, so black hole is just a thermally radiating object. So it's very difficult to distinguish black hole from some piece of wood burning. But what they found is that in order to distinguish such a system and a black hole, you really need to see this out-of-time ordered correlation function. There is some hidden, but very distinguishing feature hidden in this correlation function. So our main result is basically the following. This out-of-time ordered correlation functions will detect scrambling of quantum information. And it will tell us whether a black hole is a quantum error correcting code or not. And if I say this, actually many people say that we already know that OTO correlators detect scrambling of quantum information. To be honest, I don't know why they know it, because I think our paper is the only paper which discussed the meaning of this correlation function. And I'm going to tell you the meaning. Anyway, so in order to do this, I need to go back to this state tensor duality again. So what was this? So it's a duality between tensor and state. But I want to use it as a duality between unitary operator and the state. So first, you have this unitary operator acting on n qubits. I can write it in this way explicitly. But I'm free to view it as a qubit, as a quantum state acting on 2n qubits. And what I did is just I flipped this. And this is ket. Set to, I don't know which is which, but you just transpose it, and then you can define a quantum state. So this is the state representation of a unitary operator. So you are doubling the Hilbert space. This is very important. The reason why I want to do this is because I can view this black hole dynamics as a pure quantum state. Then I can use entanglement entropy and so on to discuss their dynamics. In your particular example, I have input qubit and the black hole state. They undergo some unitary time evolution, and then they come out under Hawking radiation and the remaining black hole. Now, of course, you can view it as a quantum state. I just put this thing. But now the point is A represents input degree of freedom, B is the input black hole, C is the output black hole, D is the Hawking radiation. Then, very roughly speaking, the statement that Hawking radiation is not enough to reconstruct this input qubit is just there is no entanglement between A and D in this state representation. And the loss of entanglement can be quantitatively measured by, let's say, mutual information between A and D and so on. And this is the power of using this state representation of the unitary operator. And if you are familiar with the recent development in string theory, actually, this is essentially the same as saying we are considering the Thermofield double state or two-sided block. I'm not going to go into details of these things. But anyway, this is the situation. Now, I think it's beneficial to look at a few examples. So this is an example with doing nothing. So my time evolution is just an identity operator. Then A comes out as D, B comes up D, C. Its state representation is this one. It's an EPR pair between AD and EPR pair between BC. Now you see that D is maximally entangled with A, so by measuring D, I can learn everything about A. It's because of this maximal entanglement. Another example is this swap operator. In this example, B comes out as D, A comes out as B, D. No, C. So anyway, this is just an EPR pair. And you see that the quantum information remains localized. There is no delocalization. And that is reflected to the fact that all the entanglement you are observing is just bipartite entanglement. But in the case of the black hole, which is scrambling, we expect that there will be a strong interaction between input and output, I mean input degrees of freedom. So you'd have some strong interaction between them. And then this probably cannot be represented as like EPR pairs or bipartite entanglement. So this will involve some multipartite entanglement. And it's actually interesting, like this is like a kind of free theory Feynman diagram, and this is like interacting theory Feynman diagram. Okay, now the reason why we need this setup is that by using this setup, we can formulate a postulate of a quantum error correcting code for black hole that is, if this system is working as a black hole, then there should be no correlation between local input and local output, right? And this loss of correlations can be quantitatively measured by the loss of the mutual information. So IAD is not correlated, IAC is not correlated. This A input is correlated only with joint region BD. That means that you need to measure both C and D in order to reconstruct. Okay, so this is the idea of this state representation of the unitary operator and so on. Okay? So now finally, I would like to come to the main result of our paper. So we basically computed out of time ordered correlation function given unitary operator, unitary time evolution operator. So you're given some arbitrary unitary time evolution operator. Then we compute this quantity. And we're going to call these regions A, these regions D, to be very specific. Now, of course, we are interested in OTOCs, but we are not that interested in particular choice of operator. We are more interested in like a generic behavior of these operators. Therefore, we decided to consider the average of OTOCs by picking these OA and OD operator randomly. So you pick random unitary operator from here, random unitary operator from here. That's what we are doing. And so this means the average of OA and OD. But it's actually mathematically equivalent to say that you pick random Pauli operator on A and random Pauli operator on D, and then do this calculation. So this is mathematically the object we are computing. Now, you might think that we don't have enough information to do the calculation because unitary operator is arbitrary, and then it doesn't seem to be like providing anything. But it turns out we can write down the answer in a very beautiful way. So first, what we do is you use the state representation. A is the input because I act the operator A on time zero. D is this region because I act the operator at the future. And then its complement is C, its complement is B, so A, B, C, D. So this is a state representation of the given unitary operator. Then it turns out this formula, we found this formula, that is 2 to the n minus a minus d minus sbd 2. So a is the volume of a, d is the volume of d. So these parts are not that important. But you notice that this is a Reni 2 entropy or joint region bd. And I think you should be surprised by seeing this formula. I'm not sure if you are surprised, because I computed like OTO correlators for regions A and D, right? But I got something about region B and D. This is not the typo. This is the equation. So it's very mysterious. So we need to actually stare at this equation for a while to appreciate the beauty of the formula. But the point is, one interpretation is the following. If this out-of-time ordered correlation function is small, then this value is very big. This means that mutual information is small. So it's a quantum error correction. And if this is small, then it's small. So these are the statements you can draw from this. Now, finally, let me argue that...
Sorry.
Yes,
sorry.
Yes.
You may have said this, but I missed the point.
Mm-hmm.
What is U?
U is any unitary operator.
So are you averaging over those?
No.
No.
You just give me one unitary operator. Yes.
Even the identity operator?
Even identity operator. Anything. Small. Anything.
Well, for the identity, it won't be small, I guess.
Sorry?
For the identity, the OTO won't be small, I guess.
Won't be small, which means that A and C are correlated. So it's, yes, consistent. Yes.
So what are we learning here? I mean, we are learning a property of...
So now, on this side, you should be confused.
You should see that. But this is a statement about an average that is valid for any U, so we're not learning anything about specific unitary transformation here.
So you just give me some unitary operator, which is like dynamics of the Hamiltonian or something, and then we are allowed to compute this OTO correlators, okay. And then somehow we run this value, SBD. Yes.
Which state are we in that correlate?
You pick your favorite unitary operator, and I will convert it into a state representation.
Oh, the BD contains information about you. SBD.
SBD, of course,
okay,
yes,
okay.
Yes, yes. Otherwise, nothing.
Yeah, I was very confused.
Yeah. Does that make sense? Or?
So you're translating unitary operator to states?
Mm-hmm.
And then you compute the correlation in that state.
Right.
And you're summing over all possible.
Right.
Randomly.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so anyway, this is a mysterious formula. So now let me tell you why this is related to quantum error correction. So first of all, so this is a setup. First of all, what Hogeng and Unruh found is they did semi-classical calculation. Basically, what they found is this autocorrelation function decays to a very small value. It's a sum of decay. But in quantum information language, by using this idea, you can actually show that AD is very small. So this correlation is very small. On the other hand, Schenker, Stanford, and Kitaev did shockwave calculation. And what they found is that this correlation function decays after the scrambling time, which is very short. Now, after the scrambling time, you notice that this IAC goes to zero because this correlator goes to zero. But this is essentially the property I'm looking for. That is, information about A does not go to C, does not go to D, but it's delocalized over C and D. So therefore, it's like a quantum error correcting code. In a sense, I define. Yeah.
So in this statement, suddenly U is something concrete, which is exponential of minus IAC.
In this case, yes, but any quantum circuit, anything is fine.
But for the second result, or the first and second result, what's the Hamiltonian? What do we mean by Hamiltonian?
Hamiltonian, let's say...
this is a statement about the black hole.
This is a statement about the black hole.
So what's the Hamiltonian?
you can think about two things. You can think about, let's say, ADS CFD correspondence, and then you can talk about the boundary CFD Hamiltonian. That's one thing. Or you can, it sounds similar, but it's slightly different. But you have black hole, and then you have asymptotic boundary, and then you shoot light from the asymptotic boundary, and then you measure the Hawking radiation, and then compute the out-of-time order correlation function. So this H could be a real black hole Hamiltonian, too. Mm. Yeah. So anyway, so this is mysterious, and I'm still really confused about this AD or AC phenomena. But anyway, so now finally I want to come back.
So go back.
Yes.
Does it matter? I mean, presumably this is after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, that's after a certain amount of time, yes.
You said after the mixing time.
After the mixing time,
but that's,
yes.
The amount of Hawking radiation that's come out there is very, very small in that short time.
Sure.
But even on that short time, when there's very little Hawking radiation that came out, C has no information about A by itself.
So after the scrambling time. But scrambling time is very, very short.
Right. I'm just saying that so in that case, D is very small.
D is very small, yes.
But you still can't
correct
for its loss, basically, on C. If you think of it as an error-correcting code.
Oh, I now understand your question. Sure. So you want to collect more and more Hawking radiation?
Well, I mean, yeah, so sure. If you wait, you know, till half the black hole is evaporated, it's kind of reasonable to say, oh, well, C is not going to have that information in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if it's a very short time, you'd think, well, it's still in there, right? I mean,
Yeah. But I think the real situation we should be talking about is, I think, more like Hayden-Preskill type thought experiment, where I'm going to talk about it, but yeah.
Okay.
So, right. So I want to briefly talk about these information puzzles because that is the underlying motivation, of course. So again, this Hayden-Preskill thought experiment. So the ordinary situation is like you throw a quantum state into black hole and then you wait for a while to collect this Hawking radiation. But they made a very interesting twist to this problem. That is, they assume that the Bob has an access to the both Hawking radiation and the black hole initial state. So this is a black hole initial state and then Hawking radiation. Then they ask what Bob can do. Then surprisingly, they found that if this U is a unit scrambling operator, meaning that if you sample it from Hall random unitary ensemble, then almost surely this is able to establish the maximal correlation between this with this state. And this is a very interesting thought experiment, but what we find is that actually their thought experiment can be quantitatively understood by using OTO correlators, because if you look at the average of OTO correlators and take a logarithm, then this is exactly equals to Reni 2 mutual information between A and BD. This means that if OTOC is small, which is a signature of scrambling, then Bob's success rate will increase. That is, Bob can establish more and more entanglement with Alice. So this is the result. So in some sense, Hayden and Preskill secretly already thought about OTO correlators, and we proved it, basically. I'm pretty sure they didn't know this, but
But I mean, in Preskill,
uh-huh.
is if you have a black hole that's
mm-hmm.
maximally entangled
right.
stuff outside.
Mm-hmm.
So is this OTO result also dependent on that? What does it apply, even if your black hole is?
So, I mean, okay. I'll just tell a very, don't go into detail, but. You can actually rely to this OTO correlators by doing this entangled pair with a black hole. And then it turns out this OTO correlator interpretation is that Alice applies random perturbations, and Bob tries to measure the result of the perturbation by comparing this outcome and the other pair of the black hole. It's like a swap test. That's the interpretation, actually. So you can rewrite this OTO correlator in a way that it involves these two sides of the black hole. Okay, then finally, let me conclude my talk by this a bit speculative slide. So I think the beauty of out-of-time model correlation function is it provides a sort of way of seeing behind the horizon, by which I mean the following. I'm assuming that I have access only to this A region or its future D. But clearly, it says that even though we have access only to A and D, somehow we are able to study like cross-horizon correlators. And this is the reason why I feel that this out-of-time ordered correlation function will play a very important role in talking about like firewall paradox and or any form of information loss puzzles. But there's one thing I actually didn't emphasize, but there is a significant like subtlety in our approaches. We have been actually assuming that our black hole is at infinite temperature. That is the reason why we are considering maximally mixed input. But the real black hole is finite temperature, so we definitely need to think about finite temperature generalization. So I mean, I'm currently working on this problem with other people, but there are many subtleties. And I mean, first of all, I mean, this chaos bound found by Maradasena, Schenk, and Stanford, it's buried only at the low temperature. You can saturate it only at the low temperature limit. So this is another way of seeing the importance of finite temperature generalization. But hopefully, by some time, I want to resolve these questions. Anyway, so this is a summary of the talk. I talked about two things which are related in the this quantum error correcting code. So I showed that ADS-CFT is a quantum error correcting code. And I also discussed that black hole is like a sort of quantum error correcting code in the sense that this information is delocalized. And then, and I showed that this OTO correlators can see this scrambling of quantum information. And so it's pretty interesting that these two ideas are related by these ideas of a quantum error correcting code. Now, let me finish the talk by talking about quantum information theory again. So I think around 10 years ago or 20 years ago, condensed matter community and the high energy community started talking about, I think, entanglement entropy. And we have many exciting results. But I want to say that entanglement entropy is a very old idea. I think it appeared around like 1932. But we live in the 21st century, so we want to use more modern quantum information theoretical idea to, you know, see some exciting many body physics. And modern quantum information was started basically by Peter Shower. He found the factoring algorithm in 1994. And many people actually forget that. So Peter is, of course, famous for factoring algorithm, but he is also inventor of a quantum error correcting code, 95, because I think he invented error correcting code because people criticized his algorithm, saying that, well, quantum entanglement is not stable. It will decohere. And then he found out a way to securely encode quantum information into many-body entangled state. So it's interesting that this quantum error correcting code finds some application in problems of the high energy physics, but it's, you know, still 1 year old. So there are many, many interesting ideas from quantum information theory which are waiting for applications. So thank you very much for your attention.
I guess we've taken a lot of questions already, but does anybody have a few quick ones?
So the OTO is an expectation value for some particular state, or it's an average over states?
State. So I'm assuming that my state is a maximally mixed state.
Okay. So it's,
and I'm computing OTO for maximally mixed state. And I should have done it for thermal state, thermal Gibbs state, of course. It's a very big difference. It's actually, I didn't appreciate this point until recently.
Right. So that answers the question I was asking before also, uh-huh. Which is that if it's a maximum tangle, maximally mixed state, then
there's
a purification out there.
Somewhere. Right.
I just have one question about the 8SFT, its correspondence between a gauge theory and a string theory. And in your toy models, there's no, at least it didn't seem like there's any gauge symmetry in the
gauge symmetry in the bulk, you mean?
Well, the gauge, the CFT is a gauge theory. In the CFT. So, and in, I mean, intuitively, one might guess that the string in the bulk is the gauge theory string.
Sure.
But,
so,
but there's nothing, as far as I can tell, there's no gauge symmetry in your story.
So, like,
is that right?
Right. I didn't talk about any symmetry at all. At the level of a toy model, I don't claim it's a real physics, but it's at the level of a toy model, it's very easy to add symmetries, for example. For example, if you want to add global symmetry, you just sample this random unitary under the symmetric space of the tensors, and then essentially you have the similar properties. And if you have global symmetry, then you are free to couple it to gauge theory, and you can talk about gauge theory if you want.
Okay, I was going to ask if you thought that was an essential. So it seems like everything without gauge symmetry involved, we produce some aspect of black hole physics, right? But are you saying that gauge symmetry is...
I need to put it by hand. So it's not emerging. I need to put it by hand.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe there is a way to argue that that must be there, but... Yeah. I mean, I can modify the tensor network toy model very easily so that it accommodates the real part of the real physics. Like symmetry, adding symmetry is pretty easy, for example.
Right, but there's nothing about the information paradox in the way you described it and its resolution that requires you to add some gauge symmetries to, right? You're saying that everything...
Oh,
is...
in the story of information loss puzzles and so on? No. I mean, in my story, I'm assuming quantum mechanics always, right? And everything is unitary, so from the beginning there is no information loss puzzle. It's like how the black hole dynamics tries to lead to, you know, the apparent loss of quantum information. So, but I mean, I don't know how to reach to this, like, conclusions starting from this tensor network toy model and so on. So. Well, maybe possible. I don't know. Yeah. Is that your gauge symmetry talking about, or maybe?
No, I'm just trying to understand why that's not. That's not seem like it's an important ingredient at all. Because you've done that. There's no gauge symmetry in the bulk or the boundary in the story. It's just some qubits, right? And it's just a qubit model.
Right.
But then you're saying it's a toy model for ADS-CFT.
Sure.
But part of what makes ADS-CFT special is that on the bulk side, it's a gauge theory. It's a gravity theory. It's the field morphism that's gauge symmetry. On the boundary side, there is also a gauge theory. It has, these young nodes, right?
Sure.
And it seems like you don't need to talk about any of those features in trying to understand the black hole information paradox.
Right. I mean, I didn't use any property of, like, black. So I mean, my whole story is pretty generic, right? It's not that limited to black holes. I mean, I don't need to talk about any specific unitary. So it's like more like a tools, theoretical frameworks. And then now, of course, that's an interesting question, but I need a physical phenomenon which really sharply requires.
So here's your example. When you have gauge theory and you study entanglement, there are edge nodes, right? So, so because gauge theory is, you have gauge theory strings, which are non-local, and making an entanglement cut in a space is going to cut this gauge theory string. So you have to ask about what happens when you make that cut, right? And there are these edge modes that appear at the entanglement surface,
uh-huh.
whose entanglement is an important element of the entanglement entropy. And that's certainly a story that one could try to use to understand the Riemann-Takenaki formula. For
example,
I think people have said this, that the Riemann-Takenaki area over 4G should, if you think about the bulk as a gate, some kind of gauge theory, should correspond to log of dimension of some boundary gauge group that lives on an entanglement surface.
Right.
So I
kind of feel that, like, if you want to just impose gauge symmetry and so on, like, I mean, it's very easy to do that. I just choose tensors with symmetries and then gauge it, and then I have such a model. But I don't know what kind of properties I should discuss with this model. Like, it will probably have like a RT like formula in the sense of some restricted algebra and so on. It's possible, but I'm just probably ignorant of that. These things, and it's. I mean, as a toy model, it's possible, but I don't know what's the real question I should address with this toy model. So that's actually the reason why I'm a bit hesitant in like further generalizing these toy models.
I see.
So maybe you can tell me about.
Yeah, maybe chat a little.
Yeah, sure.
It's a plan. Okay. Yeah, let's thank Penny again.